Maybe some of you saw me here last year when I talked about the case against André Holm, who's not my husband but my partner, which doesn't really make much of a difference. Last year I was quite shocked about having experienced such an arrest in the family and a terrorism charge, and by now I'm not much less shocked but slightly used to the fact. And in the course of the last year I have of course focused myself a lot on cases of terrorism. And in the time, I noticed that there's many such cases, and I would like to introduce some of these to you today, because I think there's many others who are similarly strange and absurd in the way they are being run, and not all of them have so much public attention. I think that the public perception of what terrorism is generally goes along rather with what actually the current EU definition of terrorism is. This definition of 2002 says terrorism offenses are committed with the aim of seriously intimidating a population or unduly compelling a government or international organization to perform or abstain from performing an act, or seriously destabilizing or destroying the fundamental political, constitutional, economic or social structures of a country or an international organization. I think the general perception of terrorism is that involves massive violence against people, many deaths, and probably some kind of situation that creates danger for a government or a state in itself. The cases that I'm going to talk to you about don't fit that description very well in my perception. I would like to say, though, that of course that the information that I have about these cases is not complete. In most cases, the investigation is still going on. It's not quite clear what really happened, and the investigation is running, and the files are generally not public, so I will tell you best of what I know, but it may not be the complete information that we might find out about later when the cases will be closed eventually, I hope so. And of course, in cases like this, political views are involved, and there's often many different views, specifically differences between the prosecution and the defendants. And I will also, of course, leave out some of the details, because I will just give a basic overview of what is going on. The first case I would like to talk about is a case that took place in Nottingham, Great Britain, where on May 14th of this year, two members of the university were arrested under the Terrorism Act of 2000 of Great Britain. Their names are Hicham Yeza and Rizwan Sabir. And they were arrested because they had copies of the Al-Qaeda training manual on their computers. One of the two had downloaded this from the United States Department of Justice website. He's a member of the university's Politics and International Relations Department. He was researching terrorism for his postgraduate studies. He was writing a PhD on the strategies of Al-Qaeda. He asked his friend and colleague Hicham, who is a former student and now works at the university, to help him with his PhD and specifically with printing out the huge document. Hicham, who used to be a member of the Senate of the Nottingham University, who is an editor of different magazines, now worked for the university in the administration, and both were arrested and held in police custody for 6 days before they were released without a charge. The charge, to begin with, was terrorism, like I said. It was then decided to not charge Hicham, who was mostly accused of the two, under the Terrorism Act. But when they were released after 6 days, he was rearrested for charges under the Immigration Act. It was also said later that if both had been maybe of Norwegian origin and maybe were blonde, then probably this wouldn't have been such a problem. But being of Arabic background, they completely fitted the stereotype of Muslim terrorists in the United Kingdom. He was rearrested under the Immigration Act, and an order for fast-track deportation was issued on May 23rd, and a deportation flight was scheduled for June 1st. This is 2 weeks after his first arrest. He had been in the UK for 13 years of residence and now had a planned deportation in less than 3 weeks after the arrest under the Terrorism Act. He was then moved around for 3 weeks from one immigration removal centre to the next. And after a huge protest campaign, of which you can see one picture, which was quite impressive, I find, he was released on bail. As far as I know, the investigation concerning his possible problems with immigration laws is still going on. On the website of the campaign, there is no complete up-to-date information as to what the situation is now, but I found it rather striking that that they were arrested to begin with. Rizwan, the one who had downloaded the manual, later said in an interview, "If they had just asked my professor why I was looking at this material, they would have understood that it was research. Instead, they chose to start an anti-terror investigation." What struck me in this case is a similarity to the case that we are as a family confronted with, which is that also here an academic is concerned, and a nice similarity is that there was a huge wave of support. The biggest demonstration ever that took place at the University of Nottingham was taking place for his support, and it is widely believed that this public support also helped to release and to drop the charges for terrorism. The next case I would like to talk about, and the case in Portugal, is a case against 150 activists who, in the August of 2007, destroyed a field of genetically modified corn plants of 1 hectare in size. This field is located in the region of Algarve, the first region in Portugal that was declared GMO-free by local authorities. It was the first time this kind of action was being carried out in Portugal. In other countries, this takes place more often, particularly in Germany. This kind of so-called mowing of GMO plant fields is actually quite common. It is considered more an action of civil disobedience, not necessarily by the owners of the fields, but by the activists. It is not considered a majorly violent action, but is tried to be seen as civil disobedience against something that is hard to protest against, which is genetically modified organisms being used now and endangering nature. This action took place during the day with press present, and until today there is a video online with a documentation of the action and reactions by the public, and especially the owner of the field. It is in no way what you would expect to be a terrorist action that is hidden in the dark, where it's impossible to identify anyone and impossible to really see what was going on. The video I find extremely interesting to see because it also includes many statements of the people who were involved. After this happened, there were strong reactions in the Portuguese media. The owner of the field received a visit by the Minister of Agriculture, by the Minister of Internal Affairs, who promised investigations, and by the President of the Portuguese Republic, who condemned the action and announced it must be punished. In September, the investigation went on. So far, there are no formal charges, but they are being threatened against the activists who don't really know what they will be facing. And the action was classified by the government as terrorism, and in result, also by Europol, who is collecting and doing statistics on cases of terrorism in the European Union. Europol said that in other cases that are falling in these fields of so-called single-issue activities, terrorism cases are divided into left-wing terrorism, right-wing terrorism, Muslim fundamentalist terrorism, and then there's a so-called single-issue terrorism. And normally these cases of single-issue activities are declared to be extremist, but not terrorism. Portugal chose to have this, the first case to be investigated under the new Portuguese law against terrorism, to have their first case of terrorism also. And so the only case of terrorism in Portugal that is reported in the Europol report for 2007 is this case of 150 activists who during the day trampled across a cornfield. There's one other case which is of right-wing extremism, which is an entirely different matter, of course. This case doesn't really have much similarity to the case against André Holm, but basically, it's a form of action. What that's maybe similar that or vaguely similar that is labeled terrorism, which normally is not that uncommon. It's the first time in Portugal that something like this happened, and it is quite obvious that the activists didn't expect this kind of reaction. They did not expect to be prosecuted as terrorists. One could argue that the actions of the militant group, which is what André is still accused to be a member of, are also mostly symbolic actions. It's not violence against people, nobody was ever hurt. It's mostly paint bombs against, for example, unemployment agencies, cars being burned, or minor property damage. The next case I would like to talk about is a case that took place in Austria, also in May this year, when 10 people were arrested through armed police in Vienna. According to the Austrian paragraph 278A of the Austrian Penal Code, which is the law that punishes forming a criminal organization, which was introduced already in 1993. This is the only case that doesn't directly involve terrorism, but has many similarities nonetheless. 23 apartments, houses, and offices were searched. Doors were kicked in by masked officers with weapons drawn. And the cause for the arrests were called the danger of suppression of evidence and the danger of committing a crime. Suppression of evidence was seen as a danger because some of the suspects had used encryption and might do so again. Danger of committing a crime was seen in the fact that some of the suspects had been politically active around issues of animal rights or animal protection. There is not visible any clear evidence that the suspects were actually involved in the attacks that they were accused of, and these attacks are first strong case they were accused of having participated in was an assumed arson attack against a hunting lodge. And in fact, it was found out later that this was caused by an oven of this lodge, which didn't work properly. And the other things that are left in the investigation now are mostly things like broken windows or glue in some door locks, graffiti, sabotaged deer stands. They were accused of sabotage of animal hunting. And in fact, what happened was that people made noise during animal hunting. And this is a sabotage. Also, there were several stink bombs against fur-selling stores. All 10 activists openly admit that they are engaged in either animal rights groups or animal protection groups. And that's an interesting thing also. They are accused of being a criminal organization, 10 people, but the 10 people that were arrested are part of two very different groups who actually don't like each other very much for ideological reasons. One are the more... you might say radical animal rights activists, and the other is the more NGO type animal protection group that do lobbying, also demonstrations, but in a nicer way if you want. The evidence that was found were tools that you can find in any household, mobile phones, t-shirts with logos, spray paints, which is a proof of their political activism. And the interesting thing also in this case is that this kind of Austrian criminal organization needs at least 10 people so that a criminal organization can be seen. And 10 people were arrested. They didn't all know each other. They definitely don't like each other all very well, but they are one criminal organization. This paragraph 278A, I was told by some of the activists I met in fall of this year, is designed to prosecute organizations regarded as organized crime. Most countries have laws like this, and specifically was used mostly like mafia-like organizations so far, and it was the first time it was used against political activists. Everyone was arrested in May, like I said, and they were actually in pretrial detention for 3 months, except for one person who was released 1 month earlier for no visible evidence other than, like I said, using encryption and similarly hard evidence. The similarity here may be same as for Andre, is that there was no real evidence presented. The evidence that was used is mostly, if you want, ideological. They were accused of having been active around animal rights, and this was apparently enough to then start an investigation with a lot of surveillance and observation in the months before, which led to gathering of little bits and pieces that are the said spray paint or logos or involvement in demonstrations, etc. Andre did a talk about his own case, I think in April or March of this year, and there was someone from Austria in the audience who then said, "My God, this is terrible that you have something like this happening in Germany. I'm glad that I live in a kind of innocent paradise where this would never happen." And in May, he got an email by the same person saying, "Okay, I need to take this back because now we've also had the same thing in Austria." Like I said, everybody was released. The charges are still being investigated, and it's unclear what is going to become of these 10 people who have spent 3 months in prison, basically, for, I would say, well, not nothing, but not very much. The next case I would like to talk about took place in New Zealand, where in October of 2007, more than 300 special forces police did raids in dozens of houses all over New Zealand, mostly in Maori. This is the indigenous communities of New Zealand. This included, for example, a school bus of kindergarten kids that was stopped and searched with drawn weapons, 60 houses being searched, a complete village being shut off. And the police said this was the response to concrete terrorist threats by indigenous activists. The result was 12 arrests under the recently created anti-terrorism legislation. And after the arrests, the Solicitor General, which is the Vice State Prosecutor of New Zealand, actually decided that this could not be a terrorism charge with the evidence that was presented. But it was in the media and for the arrested, first presented as now you are being charged with the Terrorism Act. Arrests were being made nonetheless, but after 4 weeks, all 12 were released. Today, 8 people face charges under the Arms Act for alleged participation in paramilitary-style training camps, and 5 people are also charged with being members of an organized criminal group. Also needs to be said here that New Zealand passed a new anti-terror law after 9/11, and this was the first case that was being tried under this new anti-terrorism law of New Zealand. The terrorism charge was not accepted, but the Arms Act, if they would be judged by that, would lead to 4 years of prison, and the criminal organization would result in up to 5 years of prison. The current situation is that pre-trial hearings are going on, which is a legal, well, all countries have different legal situations, and many of the Anglo-Saxon countries have this thing where they have pre-trial hearings, and only then it is decided whether a formal trial is actually started in court. And this is going on in New Zealand now for months already, and the people who are concerned say that they expect the trial maybe to start in the end of 2009. Interesting detail I find is that, since I'm talking to a chaos congress here, that the police think that an encrypted chat room was used to organize the training camps, and this encrypted chat is to be found at http://voodoochat.net. And the police apparently didn't manage to break into this chat, and therefore thinks that this is a highly conspiratorial method to organize very dangerous things just because they couldn't open it. They have no idea of what actually was talked about or organized in this. Also in the raids, several servers were confiscated, with the result that different Maori websites disappeared and are not back online until today. The public attention in this case in New Zealand was rather high, obviously. I remember finding media reports also in German or different media outside New Zealand about this case, but the attention decreased naturally after the decision not to charge under the Terrorism Act. The investigation is still going on, though, and the possible sentences that might come out of this are quite hard. What is interesting in the context of New Zealand, that last week it became known that a police informant was uncovered, who had informed police about animal rights groups, environmental groups, unions, peace groups, and the Green Party. His reports include not only details about communication methods, but also phone numbers, demonstration plans, etc., but also information on sexual relationships, travel plans, or sources of income. This is not very surprising. I mean, we all probably assume that police are using informants in any kind of community that they consider of interest for whatever reason, so that's not really surprising, but I find it rather rare that it is possible to actually find out details about how this work is being done. And it's actually quite interesting how this was done. This person who had been an informant for more than 10 years in the New Zealand activist communities had his computer broken and asked his girlfriend, who was a computer programmer, to fix his computer. She found strange emails on his computer that he apparently didn't bother to hide very well, and installed some spyware on his phone to monitor his text messages and calls, and set a script on his computer to continue sending his emails to her. She even downloaded a year's worth of phone bills and decrypted documents he had encrypted, and as a result, it became clear that he was communicating and working for the police. The similarity in this case to the case against André and the militant group in Germany is that in the beginning there was a huge public attention, and this is a similarity in many of these cases, as long as it is a terrorism case and after the terrorism charge drops, people seem to think, okay, so now we are back to legal, democratic law, state kind of structures, and everything is fine. But in fact, investigations are still going on, but under a different paragraph of the Penal Code. Next, I would like to talk about the United States. The United States, something is going on that is labeled the Green Scare, to describe legal actions of the US government against environmental and animal rights activists in the United States. The FBI calls them animal rights extremists and eco-terrorists. It's a term similar to what was used during the McCarthy era in the 50s, the Red Scare. The topic eco-terrorism appeared in 2002 in a hearing in Congress, the US Congress. And since 2000, there have been more than 20 cases of investigations and trials. Two groups are the main targets of the Green Scare, and they are the Animal Liberation Front, the ALF, and the Earth Liberation Front, the ELF. Their actions comprise what could be described as politically motivated property destruction, including large financial damage, e.g. arson to luxury villas seen as symbols of excessive consumerism, lumber companies, destructions of SUVs, releasing animals from fur farms, damage of e.g. telephone towers, and many other different things. The ELF, the Earth Liberation Front, was made the number one of the domestic terrorist threat list by the FBI. I'm quoting now, the number one domestic terrorism threat is the eco-terrorism and animal rights movement. This is a quote from CNN. We're not talking about Al-Qaeda here or Muslim fundamentalism. This is animal rights activists with doing a lot of damage. Some of the examples of cases that were put on trial here is a rather famous person. His name is Jeff Lures. He was convicted to 23 years of jail because he set three SUVs on fire. SUVs are these suburban vehicles, these huge cars that are now riding around everywhere that use a lot of gas and actually are not really a good example of environmental way of living. He did this, so he said, as a protest against excessive consumption and global warming in 2000 and 2001, when this was not yet a very prominent topic of debate. He was sentenced to 23 years of jail for this, and this was later reduced to 10 years. He is still in prison. Another example is what's called the Shack 7. They are six animal rights activists who were convicted in March of 2006. To 24 years in prison for, I'm quoting, using their website to incite hate, harassment, vandalism, and attacks against the company Huntington Life Sciences, who are running animal testing laboratories. In the words of their supporters on their website, they describe this as a website that reported on and expressed ideological support for protest activity against Huntington and its business affiliates. They were not accused of having been engaged in terrorist or threatening acts, but they were accused to conspire to promote terrorism. And for this are in prison, all of them, to 24 years. The law that is being used here mostly is a law that used to be called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and is now called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, first introduced in 1992. Another example is what is called the Operation Backfire. This is an investigation run by the FBI, and they are actually calling this the Operation Backfire since 2004. The FBI, and then there's differing information also on the FBI websites, if you dare to go there. And my impression from this is that they have been looking for a group called The Family for 10 years. Initially because this group is said to have burned down a ski resort in Colorado, causing $26 million of damage. In some reports it says this caused $12 million of damage, either in 98 or 96. And the activists who are members of this said group are either members of the Earth Liberation Front and or the Animal Liberation Front. They are accused of having done up to 25 actions of either $48 million of damage or $80 million, that's again different information, doing vandalism, property damage, animal releases and arson. In 2004, local, state and federal investigations were combined to this one investigation called the Operation Backfire. And I'm quoting again, the defendants are accused of attacks on federal land and animal management sites, private meatpacking plants, lumber facilities, and a car dealership with damages here reaching $80 million. So far, 17 people were indicted, and in these indictments, in these trials, 15 pled guilty of their actions. And so far, the FBI is still looking for 4 people to be members of this group, and there is a $50,000 reward per person set out for any information leading to arrest of these people.